This video is sponsored by Squarespace. More about them in just a moment. Recently, the Christian apologist Gavin Ortlund has argued that an atheist worldview is not just false, but will lead us into existential despair. He's made this argument both in a recent book chapter and also in a video on his channel. This is an accusation that has often been levelled at atheists, but Ortlund has put it into a precise and detailed form, and here I would like to politely disagree with him, like in some kind of YouTube response video. Before we get started, I just wanted to thank Gavin for being kind enough to go over an early draft of this script to check that I'm not misrepresenting his position. It was a massive help, and I would love for this to become more common in the world of online responses. So yes, a massive thanks to Gavin. Also, as many of you know, I'm really not a fan of how unpleasant and personal online debates can often get. So if you do want to leave a comment, could I please request that it be a respectful one? But without further ado, my name is Joe Folley, and this is unsolicited advice. 1. Gavin Ortlund's argument. In a nutshell, Ortlund's argument is contained within the title of his chapter, which is called Exposing Unbelief as Unlivable. That is, he thinks that atheism as a belief system just doesn't grant the same kind of well-being that theistic belief, and in his case, specifically Christianity, does. For Ortlund, atheism and a certain kind of existential despair sort of come as a package deal. As we'll come on to, he says that there are three undesirable things that naturally fall out of an atheist belief system. Disenchantment, meaninglessness, or nihilism, and loneliness. And that theism both doesn't suffer from these flaws, and is the natural answer to them. We can see that there is still some ambiguity in the claim that atheism is unlivable. It seems to me that there are four different ways we could roughly interpret this idea. 1. Theism is, on balance, more livable than atheism, and I'm going to call this the weak optimistic thesis. In philosophy, when we call something weak, we don't necessarily mean that it's bad. We tend to mean that it's making a more modest claim. 2. Theism is necessary for livability, and I'll call this the necessary optimistic thesis. 3. Theism is sufficient for livability. I'll call this the sufficient optimistic thesis. And 4. Theism is both necessary and sufficient for livability, and I'll call this the strong optimistic thesis. Bear this in mind, as we'll be coming back to these broad labels a few times in the video. Importantly, none of these versions of Ortlund's arguments are trying to argue directly that God exists. They're instead arguing for something like the existential desirability of God. But how does Ortlund establish that atheism deprives us of some vital philosophical goods that are necessary for livability? Well, as we just said, he argues that atheism, at least in its modern secular form, encourages three undesirable states: disenchantment, meaninglessness, and loneliness. And for the purposes of this introduction, we'll look at each one in turn. Ortlund defines disenchantment as a sense of flatness and diminishment resulting from the loss of transcendence. Like almost all feelings, it is notoriously difficult to exactly pin disenchantment down to a precise description, but I think it is at least a familiar feeling to many. Perhaps my favourite way of putting it is by the author Leo Tolstoy, who describes it roughly as follows. It is only possible to go on living while you are intoxicated with life. Once sober, it is impossible not to see that it is all a mere trick and a stupid trick. That is exactly what it is. There is nothing either witty or amusing. It is only cruel and stupid. Another alternative way of describing this feeling comes from Byung-Chul Han, who refers to a roughly disenchanted worldview as an inferno of the same. That is, everything seems the same, everything feels equivalent, and as a result, everything feels vaguely ephemeral. Han uses this phrase in a number of ways, but this is one of them. The idea, then, is that the world seems empty or robbed of vitality. Ortlund's position in this chapter is that this sense of disenchantment comes from a lack of transcendence in our worldviews. If you don't like the term transcendence, you can just think of it as spiritual grounding. That is, in a theistic worldview, and especially within a particular religious tradition, the world itself is situated as an object within a broader divine plan. It is intimately connected with something beyond the world that serves as a justification for the world and for existence. As Ortlund puts it, for most of human history, life had a kind of fullness and awe because it had larger spiritual implications. In a Christian imagination, life in this world isn't final, and this physical world itself participates in spiritual reality. It is a theatre of God's glory. In other words, the whole framing of this physical world is very different under a religious worldview to that of the modern atheist. Whereas to the modern atheist, the world is all there is, and Ortlund argues that this feels unsatisfying, to the theist, the world is enchanted by something that exists beyond and intuitively kind of above it in terms of value hierarchy. Ortlund argues that disenchantment stems from the belief that there is nothing beyond the world standing in this justifying relation to it. Ortlund's argument for atheistic nihilism is slightly different. That is his meaninglessness point as opposed to his disenchantment point, and they're not quite the same thing. Whereas disenchantment concerns the emptiness of the world, atheistic nihilism designates a lack of direction for human life. The experience of living thus becomes as flat as the bare materialistic world is under the atheistic conception. Ortlund elsewhere uses the analogy of a puzzle to illustrate his position, saying the following.
So you can see why people would experience the loss of God to be devastating like this. Think of a simple metaphor. So I like doing puzzles with my kids. Puzzles are fun because they have a meaning. The pieces are meant to fit together. Someone built a puzzle by constructing a picture and then chopping it up into pieces, putting the pieces in a box, putting the picture on the cover of the box, and now you can, you know, you're working on the puzzle and you can sort of gradually discover a coherent meaning piece by piece. Puzzles have a meaning because they have a creator like that. But imagine if you're doing a puzzle and there's no picture on the box, there's no guiding image, there's no intended outcome. And as you start to do it, none of the pieces actually fit. You have to try to jam them together. It's up to you to figure out what picture do you make out of these puzzles and how do you force them to fit together.
I quite like this puzzle analogy. It gets at the anxiety of life not having a goal or directive that comes easily and discoverably prepackaged with it. We often think that we have at least some sort of psychological need to have an organization to our actions, just because without any kind of aim, we tend to fall into confusion and despair, and we tend to want to have some kind of coherent character that gives sense to what we do and behave and think in the world. This is a pretty consistent theme in a lot of philosophical writings around happiness or well-being. It's found in some form in everyone from Marcus Aurelius to Friedrich Nietzsche. Ortlund's point is that without a designer or a purpose giver to appeal to, we have no way to ground any particular aim or set of aims that we might have. Sure, we can find things to do in a merely descriptive sense, but there's no reason to pick one particular aim over another in a way that supersedes our arbitrary human preferences. That is, from the perspective of the universe, every aim would be as good, and incidentally as bad, as any other. On the other hand, under theism, we can appeal to God's supreme authority to determine what our purpose is. We come prepackaged with a purpose kind of just built into us, and that can be existentially comforting. The other component to Ortlund's meaninglessness argument is that, under an atheist worldview, everything in life is extinguished at the moment that life ends. There is no next world to which we pass on, and there's nothing waiting for us on the other side. This is the only existence we have, and that arguably does make our lives seem less meaningful than they otherwise would be if they went on forever, or at least for a much longer amount of time. If nothing else, there's just a sheer quantity argument to be made here. As Tim Mawson has argued, provided that you think that there is something meaningful about your existence, the idea of it going on for longer should, at least on its face, make it more meaningful, just in the sense that there is more of whatever was meaningful about it in the first place. If you take meaning in something like eating sandwiches, then an eternity of eating sandwiches seems more meaningful than a mere 70 years of eating sandwiches. It's a crude example, but I think it gets the point across, though you can argue against it by making various claims about whether the finitude or finality of this life adds meaning in some sense. I'm not saying this is a decisive argument, I'm just saying that this at least has some kind of prima facie plausibility to it. And finally, Ortlund holds that our modern problems with rising loneliness can also at least benefit from a religious touch. This is from Ortland's chapter, but he hasn't dwelt on it too much in later interviews, and it takes a long time from writing a chapter to that chapter being published, so I'm going to treat this as a less significant part of his argument. Whereas he argues that secular atheism implies meaninglessness and secular atheism implies disenchantment, he seems to hold a much more modest thesis for loneliness. That is, he thinks that religion can help with our general loneliness crisis, though it might not be necessary to solve it. In this, I would actually probably agree with Ortland. Although I don't think that it has anything to do with specifically religious belief, I do think that religious communities, like other communities, can help with people's sense of loneliness and not belonging. I also think that while a shared religious belief system isn't strictly necessary for this, having a shared creed is just a pretty good way to practically get a community going, because it's a shared point of interest for each of the participants. Something that I thought was really interesting about Ortland's chapter is that these points compare pretty favorably with Leo Tolstoy's criteria for what he calls the essence of religion. I've mentioned these before on the channel, but just to remind everyone, they are roughly as follows. 1. Religion must explain some overarching order or sensibility to the universe. 2. It must show that our lives matter after death. And 3. It must provide us with a reason to care for one another. So, as you can sort of see, each one of these coheres with one of Ortland's points: disenchantment, nihilism, and loneliness. Gavin clarified that this was unintentional in our correspondence, but I just thought it was kind of cool. There are a couple of nuances in Ortland's argument that I want to address before we move on. The first is that he doesn't think that atheists necessarily feel the kind of meaninglessness and disenchantment in a conscious way that he thinks atheism entails. He in fact argues that we find many ways to distract ourselves from the truth of our implicit atheist commitments. His point is a little bit more like the following. If an atheist were to recognize the full extent of what their belief system entails, then they would feel disenchanted and nihilistic. This claim is still somewhat empirical, and I will still be arguing against it later in the video. My point is, we can't just point to a happy atheist and say, behold a counterexample. The second nuance is that he's specifically talking about modern secular materialist atheism. In theory, you could appeal to non-physical Platonism about meaning without introducing a personal god, but that's not the kind of atheism that Ortland is addressing. So, that's his argument in a nutshell. Let's first move on to points of agreement before we examine my points of contention with Gavin's position. But before moving on, I just want to take a quick moment to thank today's sponsors, Squarespace. If you're looking to build a website, then you know it can be a real pain. First, you have to choose a domain name and then construct the entire thing. And there's always this underlying fear that you're messing it up and creating something that doesn't just look untidy, it actually looks unprofessional. But this is where Squarespace comes into play. They take all of that headache and hassle and compress it down into a single platform, using ready-made templates to eliminate most of this needless complication out of website building. Their block-based Fluid Engine editing system is also so easy to use and makes it simple to integrate anything you want into your website without having to master some elaborate coding language. Head to squarespace.com/unsolicitedadvice and use the code unsolicitedadvice to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain name. But anyway, back to the video. 2. Ortland has a point. On the whole, I think that Ortland's argument provides a pretty good outline of genuine existential weak points in secular atheism, or at least potential weak points. I also think that it illustrates a very important point that a lot of modern atheists, very much including me in the past, have overlooked, which is that God, for better or for worse, has been the linchpin of an awful lot of our philosophical systems, at least in Europe and North America, for the past millennium and a half. We shouldn't expect to be able to surgically remove God without it affecting any of the connected philosophical tissue. It's not God is dead, so let's just carry on exactly as before, but with a lie-in on a Sunday morning. If we were to put the broad structure of Ortland's argument in propositional form, it would probably look something like this. 1. A belief in order and a belief in pre-existing purpose are necessary for the existential well-being of human beings. I'll occasionally call this the doxastic premise after doxas, which is the Greek word for belief. 2. A belief in God entails beliefs in order and pre-existing purpose. 3. There is no way to attain these beliefs in order and pre-existing purpose without God. For, therefore, a belief in God is both necessary and sufficient for the existential well-being of human beings. I will go on to disagree with premise one and premise three, but I think premise two is pretty strong. I think a belief in most popular forms of theism does entail a belief in order and pre-existing purpose. I don't think this is that controversial to say, but to briefly spell it out, if there is a God who designed the universe, including us, with a specific intention in mind, then we can say that the reason the world is the way it is because God has willed it to be that way. And we can say that our purpose is to align ourselves with God's will and his intention in creating us. This is not just a feature of our own contingent modern religions either. The Stoics thought that the notion of providence explained both why the universe was the way it was and provided us with a purpose, which was to align ourselves with its will. You can see this in almost every Stoic author. Just as a knife's job is to be sharp, our job is to align ourselves with God's will. However, despite this initial agreement, I do think that premise two by itself might need some additional refining. For instance, I don't think just any kind of order and any kind of meaning will do. Take the example of Gnosticism. To remind everyone, Gnostics held that the material world was not created by a good god, but by a malevolent demiurge. Belief in this demiurge gives the world order, in that it was created in line with the demiurge's will, and also provides us with a kind of pre-existing design purpose, since the demiurge created the world, in part, to prevent us from achieving gnosis and uniting with a higher spiritual god. I'm willing to be proven wrong here, but I think the kind of order and purpose that the demiurge provides is not the one that would satisfy most people. Let's take the higher god out of it for simplicity. If the world were created to cause us suffering, and our purpose, according to the demiurge, was to suffer, I just don't think that would bring people much existential fulfillment. So it's not merely the existence of a creator deity that provides the kind of existential fulfillment that Ortlund argues for. It is a god whose order and purpose we, from our own perspective, also judge to be good. That is, God endorsing our purpose is insufficient. We must also endorse it. I have a feeling that this constraint is not often brought up because God, at least as we normally talk about him, is defined as all good, so it's sort of taken for granted that we would endorse his reasons. But in order to illustrate this, to bring this constraint home, consider a religion or religious sect that you personally find existentially repugnant. We can realize that were this particular religion's God true and existent, you would find your life less rather than more meaningful. And the world might feel enchanted, in a sense, but only because you've moved from neutrality to condemnation, which it's not really gaining territory, existentially speaking. It's not the kind of meaning that we're searching for. That being said, this does still leave it open that both our own reflective endorsement and God's endorsement are necessary for existentially fulfilling order and purpose, in which case atheism would still be devastating, but God would no longer be sufficient for either enchantment or meaning. Although, and we'll come onto this a little bit later, it does open the question as to what is doing most of the work there. Is it our own perspective, our own personal endorsement of a particular purpose, or is it God's endorsement, or is it 50-50? Because, well, as I'll go on to argue, I think that plausibly this will vary between people. I don't think that it's necessarily a problem for the theist, or at the very least the Christian, however, that God and belief in a higher being in itself might not be sufficient for existential fulfillment. Because there are figures in the Bible who are, you know, absolutely certain of God's existence, but still feel a deep sense of existential despair. The best example of this is probably King Solomon, the purported author of Ecclesiastes, who discusses how, despite his definite belief in God, he still finds life pretty empty, at least he finds it that way a lot of the time. And traditionally, Solomon is supposed to be the wisest person who ever lived. So I do sort of think that the theist can bite this bullet and instead say something like, of course God's plan for us also needs to align with our own existential needs in order to fulfill us, but God is good and so would and does do just that. I also agree that, at the very least, the kind of extended life offered by most theistic traditions would genuinely make life more meaningful for a lot of people. This is just because of that Mawson argument given earlier. If there are things in your life that you find meaningful, then the right kind of afterlife would allow for those to go on longer. It's one reason why I think a lot of people imagine seeing loved ones in the afterlife. I think one of the reasons why we imagine this is because that is something that we find meaningful in our own lives, and we're imagining that going on in the next life. And I think that sort of afterlife would plausibly make someone's life more meaningful because it would allow them more time with loved ones. And my final point of agreement with Ortlund's argument is that the prospect of a good or a bad eternal afterlife does add additional significance to our actions from a purely personal perspective. As a Catholic friend of mine once put it, the prospect of an eternal hell keeps me off Tinder. This can make life feel more meaningful for sort of the same reason that getting married feels more meaningful than choosing to have a cappuccino instead of a cup of tea at a coffee shop. The choice of getting married to someone just has more long-term consequences. Though, incidentally, it isn't anything philosophically significant about God's goodness or God's plan that's adding the meaning here. It's rather the bare consequences of God's decisions. God adds meaning in this case in the same way that anyone with power over our long-term fate would. And I'm not necessarily sure that that is exactly the kind of meaning that most Christian apologists are after. I could be wrong, though. So, essentially, I agree with Ortlund that with the right kind of God, the right kind of eternity, and the right kind of felt existential needs, belief in God would plausibly make life more existentially fulfilling than without him. That's a lot of caveats, and importantly, it does fall short of showing that atheism is unlivable. However, in my view, Ortlund's argument is a pretty good prima facie point in favour of the weak optimistic thesis from earlier, at least with regards to some people. So, those are the points of agreement. Now onto the points of disagreement. If you want to help me make more videos like this, then please consider subscribing, either to the channel, or if you're feeling incredibly generous and want to gain access to exclusive content, including my slow motion book-by-book bookshelf tour, then consider subscribing to the Patreon, though it's absolutely no pressure. The links are in the description. 3. Atheism strikes back. There are two main points of contention that I have with Ortlund's argument. The first is that I dispute the idea that God and eternity are the only possible things that can give a human life felt value, and the second is that I do think that there are at least significant existential drawbacks to a theistic position, and these are worth considering if we're evaluating how livable atheism is when compared with theism. Firstly, I think there is a perfectly natural but slightly hasty inference going on in the claim that God is the only thing that could make life seem meaningful. It is undeniable, at least in my view, that God has been one of our primary sources of meaning for over 1,000 years, and that a sudden shift from belief to non-belief will thus rob us of a major pre-existing source of meaning. The philosopher John Stuart actually gives a really nice overview of this process in his book Nihilism in the 19th Century, where he details how a lot of people felt really quite helpless when their beliefs in God and their belief in eternity were made uncertain by various philosophical and scientific advances. Additionally, I have just spoken to quite a lot of people who once were very religious and then ceased to be so, and many of them do describe an accompanying crisis of meaning as a big pillar of their existential acropolis is snatched away. My problem comes when Ortlund infers from this that there is no other belief system that possibly could fulfill our existential needs apart from some kind of theism. It's a little bit like going through a bad breakup and immediately concluding that no one else other than your ex could ever make you romantically happy. We see people make these inferences all the time, and we recognize that they're very natural, that they feel very right, but ultimately they are mistaken. Here, I think we're making the same slightly hasty inference, but just in the case of God. Just because theism has been our existential grounding doesn't mean that it has to be going forwards. Of course, this inference would be perfectly fine if you, in fact, already believe that God exists and has designed us with a need for him in mind. But if the argument relies on already believing in God for it to work, then I think it loses quite a lot of its bite. In order for his conclusion to follow, Ortlund would need to show that God is the only possible belief system that can fulfill these existential requirements that we looked at earlier. I don't think that he has currently, and I would argue that there are good reasons to think that there are alternative existential comforts open to us. And I think part of this is that different people might need different things in order to give their life a felt sense of meaning. The first piece of evidence I have for this is just that there currently are atheists who are existentially fulfilled, who also seem to be able to point to things in their life that they say make their life meaningful. They might point to their family or their work or their personal set of values. The ability to give reasons here is very important, as it shows that they are not unreflectively fulfilled. They are able to construct a coherent and existentially fulfilling philosophy without invoking God. At the very least, this gives us some reason for thinking that at least some atheistic lives can be fulfilling. Of course, Ortlund does anticipate this response in his chapter by arguing that such atheists can only maintain this sense of meaningfulness by not being fully aware of the consequences of their atheism. Their nihilism is sort of bubbling away beneath the surface, waiting to be unearthed by a realization. We can imagine what this might look like. Tolstoy, again, provides a very good example. He describes suddenly realizing that his previous non-religious life had never really fulfilled him, certainly not in the same way as his life as a devout Christian did. I have two possible issues with Ortlund's reply here. The first is just that I'm not entirely sure how we would go about demonstrating it. I can't see how he would check whether someone has truly seen the consequences of their own atheism. If I were trying to convince an atheist of this position, I might ask them whether they recognize that their atheism precluded things like eternal life or having a pre-existing purpose in life. And they might reply yes to these questions, yet still insist that they feel perfectly fulfilled. I don't know how I would demonstrate that they were wrong in either in the sense that they weren't fulfilled or in the sense that they hadn't truly sussed out the consequences of their atheism. The only way I could see doing this would be to take their signal of fulfillment as evidence that they hadn't truly realized the consequences of their atheism, but that would just be assuming our conclusion at the outset. Alternatively, another way I think we could have a go at demonstrating the bubbling unfulfillment of atheism would be to point to cases where atheistic sources of meaning have failed people, where a particular crisis has thrown an atheist into a spin, and thus atheist meanings have been shown as unstable for them. Ortlund touches upon this a little bit in his chapter, but I don't quite think that this works either, because I think the atheist can ultimately pull the same maneuver. The atheist can point to where believers have had a crisis of faith due to some personal tragedy. I don't think that it follows from that that they had some pre-existing nihilism that came bubbling to the surface through this crisis. And I don't think that this follows from cases of instability in certain atheistic sources of meaning either. I'm also very open to the idea that a great number of people might be more fulfilled believing in God than when irreligious. However, I'm hesitant to conclude that this holds for all people, or that this is something that would necessarily hold across time. It's possible, I just don't think it's been demonstrated. Again, God has been the linchpin of our philosophical system for centuries. It is unsurprising that we would be a little unskilled at crafting worldviews that are both non-theistic and existentially fulfilling and appeal to a wide range of people. This is even something that Nietzsche pointed out in his Critique of Religion, saying that one of the reasons the ascetic ideal has been so successful is because it is the only way so far that we have been able to make our suffering meaningful. He just disagrees that this is the only possible way we could do this. The difference between this is an incredibly popular way of making life meaningful and this is the only way of making life meaningful is, philosophically speaking, pretty major. If the second is true, then it suggests that theism is the only existentially livable philosophy, and living without theism is sort of the equivalent to living without food. If the first is true, then it's more like the equivalent of living without bread. Sure, it's going to be kind of inconvenient, at least for most people, and it will be a much bigger deal for some than others, but on the whole, we may be able to adjust. I just want to say here that I do think that it is understandable how a theist might come to the conclusion that atheism is unlivable. I think something's going on like this. If you want to ask whether a worldview is unlivable, it sort of makes sense to ask the question, how would I feel if I were in this worldview? And I think when the theist does this, they quite accurately conclude that this would make them despair. But I don't think this can be used to demonstrate atheism's unlivability, because atheists may well have different existential needs than theists, as well as different existential conclusions. That is, atheists may be, at least on average, fulfilled by relatively different things than most theists. I don't think we have much reason a priori to think that everyone would be existentially fulfilled by the same set of beliefs. After all, people have different food preferences. They fall in love with different people. They prefer to spend their time differently. So I'd be pretty surprised if it turned out that despite broad divergence on a wide range of other desires, needs, and preferences, all humanity had broad convergence at the level of existential preference. I may be wrong, but I just think the onus to argue this position would be on the theist to empirically demonstrate convergence here, because we do know that at least some divergence exists. What the theist, I think, would need to demonstrate is that there is near universal convergence on the felt need for a god or godlike figure for existential fulfillment. And ultimately, I think that is an empirical point that I don't think has been demonstrated. We'll come on to a bit of the empirical evidence later, but I'll also say a bit as to why I think it's not necessarily that reliable. Anyway, I've gone off script, so I'm going to get back to it. To give one example of someone who seems to have wildly divergent existential needs than the theist, take the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. Sartre famously argued that life would actually be more existentially fulfilling without God than with God. He prized the ability that humans would have in an atheistic world to shape their own authentic selves through their choices, and thought this was only possible if God did not design a purpose for us. For him, if God existed, it would actually detract from our ability to live existentially fulfilled lives. This is another thing that Mawson discusses in his book. Now, I wouldn't go nearly as far as Sartre here. I would instead just argue that some people probably lean more towards the Sartre camp and others more towards the Ortlund camp, and that I can't see a way of adjudicating between the two apart from just to say that they have different psychological and philosophical needs and thus different standards of livability. This is not to say that someone could not move from one camp to the other. I think this often probably does happen when someone either gains or loses their faith. There's no reason to suspect that someone's existential needs might stay the same across time. I just don't think that we can infer much about atheism or theism as belief systems from this. We can just infer something about believers and non-believers and the kind of things that might fulfill or do not fulfill them. And it's not just Sartre. When polled, people tend to say that many different aspects of their life give them meaning, such as family and community and personal growth, as well as, yes, religious and spiritual traditions. Now, personally, I don't actually place that much stock in this because I couldn't find studies that investigated the relationship between these factors. So, for example, it could be that while family is the most important thing to someone, it is given that importance because of faith or something like that. I thought this empirical evidence was worth mentioning, but I also wanted to mention some of its flaws as well. I think it does give us some reason to adopt the stance that people probably do have different existential needs and different weightings on those existential needs, but I don't think it's a slam dunk piece of evidence or anything like that. Maybe a good example to illustrate the differences in existential needs is how differently people react to the prospect of being sentenced to either eternal bliss or eternal torment at the end of time. Setting aside theological positions like annihilationism or universalism, the prospect of each action having eternal implications isn't necessarily as comforting for a lot of people as it might initially seem. Sure, it makes actions significant, but significance and livability are not totally coextensional. The tendency for some is to scrutinize their own actions obsessively to see if they are in a state of mortal sin and thus destined for eternal torment. This is even a sin of its own, known as scrupulosity, with a large volume of theological literature written about it. For those prone to scrupulosity, belief in God is not always existentially comforting, but can be existentially terrifying. For them, God does add meaning to their lives, but sort of in the sense that someone giving you a bag and saying that a bomb might be in it would liven up your day. Sure, events would take on a new, profound significance, but significance can be negative as well as positive. I do want to note here, though, that unlike some non-believers, I don't think this shows that theism is unlivable. I just think it shows that some are disposed to find the concept of eternal life with bliss and torture on the table comforting, and others are disposed to find it terrifying. There is human variation here. And ultimately, it's this variation that's the main point of disagreement that I have with Ortlund's argument. I think that implicitly it assumes that all human beings have roughly the same existential needs, and then argues that theism is the thing that fulfills those needs. I am skeptical that human beings have roughly the same existential needs, and so I disagree with one of the key argumentative levers in Ortlund's argument. Of course, Ortlund does have an obvious response he can use here, which is to say that whether the atheist recognizes it or not, or whether they will ever recognize it or not, they have no rational grounds for thinking that their life is meaningful. This appeals to a standard higher than simply individual people's feelings on the matter, and so would allow him to argue that the atheist is just wrong if they think their life is meaningful, in the same way that someone might think that 3 hours of scrolling on TikTok makes their life better, but is mistaken, because we have an objective or semi-objective standard of prudential goodness that we can appeal to. In order to make this argument, the theist would need to lay out some mutually acceptable criteria for both the atheist and the theist over how we can rationally infer livability from a set of descriptive beliefs about the universe without appealing to peculiar and variable facts about human psychology. However, at least in my opinion, a problem immediately emerges, because I'm just not sure what such a set of criteria would look like. Even the theist does not infer the meaningfulness of their life directly from the existence of God using some kind of incontrovertible logical law. It's instead that the existence of God secures the kind of things that the theist finds psychologically and existentially valuable. It's entirely possible that we may come up with some kind of universally applicable criteria for what really makes an existentially meaningful life without appealing to these variable psychological needs, but I am skeptical of this. And finally, we saw in the last section that it's not sufficient for God to endorse a given meaning for life for that meaning to be meaningful for us. There we said that the theist can reply that God giving us meaning is still necessary for existential fulfillment, but it's just not sufficient for it. We have to endorse that meaning as well. However, now we're going to question that reply. To return to Ortlund's puzzle example, is it the fact that there is one predefined solution that makes the puzzle motivating to complete, or are there other things that would make the puzzle just as subjectively motivating? So, say I gave you a puzzle to solve and said that the puzzle had no predefined solution, but that you can make it into a large number of very beautiful shapes, with those shapes not being picked out by the designer. You know, it's a sort of collection of curves and straight lines. I actually had this sort of puzzle game when I was a child, and I really enjoyed it. But to stretch the metaphor slightly, this indicates that having one predefined solution is not the only thing that can motivate us to complete a puzzle. The fact that there are multiple solutions that make sense from our vantage point is just as good, even if that wasn't intended by the designer. It seems that subjective coherence can be just as motivating as one preordained design, at least as far as puzzle pieces are concerned. And I would argue that the same holds true for life. In other words, I'm asking, what's doing the majority of the work here? Having a predefined meaning, or endorsing that predefined meaning from our standpoint? And I would argue that it's the latter. And if it is the latter, well then, it is possible that the former is not as necessary as we thought. There are some counterarguments I can think against my point here, but if I start giving them, this video is going to get a lot longer, and it's already far, far too long. So I'm going to move on to our final section. 4. How I would make this argument. I'm not really a fan of saying where I disagree with an argument and not saying at all how I would steelman it to start to get around my criticisms. So, here goes. As I said, my point of contention with Ortlund's argument is its universality, the idea that atheism itself is unlivable. But I think there is a version of this argument that doesn't appeal to universality at all. I think it might go something like the following. It may be the case that you find atheism perfectly existentially acceptable. But there's good reason to think that if you value certain things like continued existence after death or a pre-existent purpose for your life and the knowledge that a being of infinite significance loves you, then you might consider whether theism would make your life more meaningful than atheism. I think this is a stronger argument for a number of reasons. The first is that it doesn't claim that atheism itself is unlivable, but just that theism may be more livable. The second is that it doesn't rely on universal scope, but at the same time references things an atheist could plausibly value. Hell, I would like more quantity of existence than this life will provide, and it would be nice to think that an infinite being loves me. And the third is that I think it can still serve the role of arguing that theism may be, on balance, at least a more straightforwardly existentially comforting view than atheism for some people. We could extend this argument further if we wanted, and try to argue for the primacy of theist existential solutions over atheist ones. Even if we accept that there are various atheist philosophers like Nietzsche, Sartre, and Camus, who have each crafted potentially existentially fulfilling worldviews without God, and even if there are, in fact, a myriad things that can and do fulfill atheists, well, we could still argue that theism does things better than these other theories. We could point to some straightforwardly practical things, like that theism may be more accessible, with most towns being home to at least one major world religion, if not more. We can point to pre-existing authorities, like priests, to guide us on our way. There are far more priests than there are scholars of absurdism. We could also point to the fact that we know many people have found fulfillment in theism, so there is good evidence that it's possible if you're currently in some kind of meaning crisis. There's not the same evidential basis for the utility of Nietzsche's philosophy or existentialism or absurdism, even though I personally do think that these philosophies can be very helpful. So there's room for the theist to argue that we can accept the existence of alternative fulfilling worldviews and yet still make a positive case that religion is better. It doesn't need to be a knockdown argument against atheism. It could just be a comparative argument that gives some credence in favour of religion's existential appeal. This would involve a more modest conclusion than originally proposed. Instead of arguing that non-belief is unlivable, we would now be arguing that religion is a tried and tested, but not infallible, means to attaining existential fulfillment. And I still think this could fulfill the rhetorical function that Ortlund desires for his own argument. He's very open that he doesn't aim at demonstrating God's existence here, just his desirability. It's an argument aimed at opening hearts. And I think this version of the argument does much the same thing, but with slightly more secure premises, at least in my view. On the other hand, this new argument is much more vulnerable to atheists simply stating that they don't find atheism unlivable. And in the face of such a statement, the theist can only reiterate what they take to be the negative consequences of atheism. If the atheist has not fully grasped them, and they actually do have existential needs that are amenable to a theist treatment, then this may genuinely help them see that atheism is not fulfilling their existential needs after all. However, if the reflective atheist still sees atheism as perfectly livable, or sees theism as no more livable, then there's not much that the theist can say in response to that. But I don't think there was much that the theist could ever say in response to that, so I don't necessarily think that's a weakness of this version of the argument. And finally, I do think there is some merit in simply raising the existential challenge to non-theistic worldviews, given how tightly aligned the questions of existential fulfillment and religion have been historically. I agree that it is slightly strange to think that we could just eliminate God from our worldview and expect nothing to change. Over the centuries, we've become very used to justifying our own existence with some transcendent thing beyond ourselves, something eternal and out there. I don't think that such a mental habit is necessary or essential to being human or essential to being existentially fulfilled for at least some people, but I do think that it's there. Coming up with non-theistic narratives and worldviews that are existentially fulfilling isn't a task that can simply be hand-waved away. It must be constructed. And as I've argued before, the avenues for doing this are large and varied, and importantly for me, they may not be the same for every individual person. It might involve building straightforward belief systems. It might involve particular physical or psychological habits. We all know things like exercise, a proper diet, and financial security are pretty integral to well-being. It will probably involve some mixture of the physical and the psychological and the philosophical. But this is a task that, at least in my view, atheists and non-believers like myself sort of ought to want to rise to. I think it's quite philosophically exciting. So, yes, I ultimately do think that Ortlund's argument doesn't demonstrate its conclusion, but I do think it's worth looking at. I still think it highlights some important questions for us unbelievers to deal with. And I think it raises some really interesting issues about whether humans all have the same existential needs. I think that's a fascinating question in its own right, and gives us a slightly different perspective from which to look at existential questions as a whole. And I think this is definitely worth looking at, whether you're an atheist or a theist. But if you want to check out some other theistic arguments, I went through a whole bunch of them in an interview with the wonderful Joe Schmidt right here. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.